You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are at the end of September 2024. This is being recorded on the evening of the 28th, and I'm happy to say I've been looking forward to this for a while. A friend of mine, a longtime listener, asked me to consider the topic we're going to deal with today. And I thought it was a great idea. And that topic is the philosophy of Pavel Florensky. And, you know, I've covered so many of these men, this explosion of theological and metaphysical thought roughly around the turn of the 20th century in Russia, largely based, at least to some extent, on the symbolist movement, which I've dealt with a long time ago, a Platonizing movement in Russia. Remember, the mainstream, say, in 1900 was still positivist in many ways, including in the seminaries, something that Florensky had stated. Now, for his part, Florensky was born in 1882. He was murdered in 1937. Lived in both the Russian Empire, of course, and the USSR. And he was executed without any kind of a trial or anything like that on the way to another gulag camp. He has a mixture of Russian, Georgian, and Armenian blood. He comes from a family of clergy on his father's side who is for the most part Russian. But more importantly, he comes from a firmly Orthodox background regardless. So many of the men that I've dealt with around this turn of the century religious revival are challenging positivism, challenging nominalism, challenging this very simplified view of what science is, which went vaguely by the term nihilist. Nihilist means positivist, that the only thing that's real are those things that can be fit into scientific language. Otherwise, I mean, that they held to dogmatically. Everything else simply didn't exist or didn't matter. And a lot of these men, everyone from Simeon Frank to Florensky to Bulgakov, and the symbolists, some of them were not Christian, but they certainly gave the foundation for something greater, even if they were the weirdo neo-pagan. But they still, very successfully, challenged the prevailing orthodoxy, especially in Western Europe. And it's only really been since the fall of the USSR that these writers have been translated. The major works, Pavel Florensky, are available in English, the minor ones not so much. But in his work and his education, he eventually was ordained a priest. He was actually a scientist, focusing on mathematics and physics. And when he began, we'll talk about this more here in a minute, but when he began to connect the sciences to the spiritual realm, he was arrested. And in this series of, you know, shifting him from one camp to another, they just got rid of him in 1937. In other words, he never fled the USSR, and it cost him his life. It's difficult to start these things. It's difficult to end these things. We're talking about a system, more or less, where everything fits into everything else, which in and of itself is a metaphysical principle. modernity, modernism, for Florensky is the same thing as fragmentation. And he says the same about the evolutionary doctrine, which was a tremendous leap in the scientific ideology. Evolutionism is a theory as to how everything that exists can come from nothing. And doing this with a million very small leaps in development. Now, when we talk about fragmentation, one of the things he brings up is the idea of a differential equation. Now, I'm no mathematician. I avoided that except for statistics. I avoided it a good chunk of my life, but the way that Florensky describes it, it's the inability of the Western world to deal with processes, since they're very complex. The differential equation is based on the principle that any process then has to be broken down into much smaller static bits. So motion, for example, is studied by breaking it up into many pieces, every one of which is not in motion. In other words, breaking up motion into very small segments of rest. In other words, it can't grasp process, it can't grasp its own history, it only knows the present. As for evolutionism, this was a next step in the scientific mentality. It's taken for granted that there's really no serious difference between a human being and an orangutan. Though in many cases, human beings live up to that, but we're capable, of course, of much more. But then evolutionism went from a myriad of small changes to enormous leaps once in a while. Qualitative change suddenly occurs. Now, the principle of evolutionism is just adaptation. That's not a huge deal. No one has ever denied that from Plato on down. But that's not really what we're talking about. On the other hand, the Old Testament, which he compares to whatever variant of Darwinism was fashionable at the time, the Old Testament can be looked at scientifically in this very same process. It is the purification of the genetics over time such that it will come to create the flesh from which Christ will spring. In other words, the Mother of God, the Holy Seed. And a lot of what happens, especially from a physical point of view, is this process of purification to eliminate gangrenous accretions on human life, which is why so many groups were wiped out. Their continued existence and growth would be damning to the planet. And he goes so far as to say that the fall of Adam led to a genetic change, that mankind was split into Cain and Abel. But that eventually resolved itself through the mentality of the Old Testament to the Mother of God as the very peak of purity, and hence Christ becomes the central axis of history. The Old Testament, at many levels, not merely the scientific, prepares us to understand this. And you know I've said so many times that without the Old Testament, the New Testament doesn't make a lot of sense. You need to know the Old Testament before, especially Christ's personal utterings, can be properly interpreted. Now, I mentioned how a system where every piece fits into every other is an ontological and metaphysical principle. It's really the building blocks of what we call form, in the Platonic sense, the archetype, to be found collected in logos. A change in one piece, one quality, one trait, no matter how minor, given the nature of this system, has to affect everything else. And this is where form can first be discerned. form, of course, and we're going to expound on this in great detail, form is beyond space and time and is a matter of spirit. But in terms of stability and strength, the more spiritual something is, the stronger it is. And the more material something is, the more unstable it becomes. Form, the whole, determines the parts, and they eventually emerge as the archetypes. And this can be found in cosmic logos. Around us, we see not evolution, but devolution. That's the one theory I do believe in. Everything dies, everything decays, entropy is everywhere. And yet everything expands. And yet life is not daunted. Life in the face of death. It's an old poetic image. This is the force of logos against entropy. Everything is able to be decomposed. Decomposable, so to speak. And the only thing that produces stability and knowledge is spirit, which in and of itself is a force. Now, when it comes to the presence of things, the concept of thingness, an objective brute given, and we talked about this with Berdyaev, and this is a more human connection. The thing is unfree. The process of making it, however, is free. And that is either creativity or labor. And in Russian, those two terms are very close. Sometimes they use the same word for both. The opposite of labor, I mean creative labor, real labor, is objectivity, the existence of a thing, an object, the objective world. Since the Renaissance, or so Florensky says, philosophy and the sciences have been aimed and oriented to the thing, towards objectivity and materialism, physicality. Now you fast forward to the postmodern age, which started somewhere in the early to mid-19th century, but only in our present sense of postmodernity through Michel Foucault, who I've also dealt with on this show, this series of lectures. The postmodern conception, if you could even call it that, is a third alternative between labor on the one hand and objective reality, physical reality, on the other. Postmodernism rejects the thing, the X, whatever it might be, as some singular hardened shell that we can talk about. It removes thingness. It may keep the word, it may keep the pronunciation, but it removes the thing. And this began, I don't want to exaggerate this, but Florensky says it began with Immanuel Kant, who determined cracks and weaknesses in human reason, meaning that rationalism, to have a fully grounded system solely in rational precepts, formal logical precepts, can't work, and it's not possible. And I talked about Hegel. I dealt with that at great length. In the Critique of Pure Reason, I took a whole class on this in grad school from the late, great Nelson Potter. Kant early on lays out equally valid antimonies, things that seem to be opposites. And you could make an excellent case, and they're both logical, and you can make an excellent case for them. That's the problem. If reason can, in certain areas, make an equally compelling logical case for opposing points of view, then reason's the problem. But the antimony for Florensky is the origin of dialectics. It's not a weakness. It's an opportunity. It's a sign of vitality. So when all's said and done, whether it be positivism, nominalism, evolutionism, mechanism, all of those are, philosophically speaking, synonymous. Mechanism, or the simple mechanized cause and effect, with no organic adaptation or anything else. just a machine in motion, put it like that. It's based on the rejection of time. It's based on the rejection of real history. Now, in 1914, he wrote a book called The Meaning of Idealism. And this is where we talk about this very concept. And he talks about the four dimensions of reality, the fourth being his conception of time. And that the idea of the archetype, the form, is based on phenomena, but not just any kind of phenomena. What he calls the originary, in other words, the origin phenomena. But with those kind of phenomena, space and time are negated since they are spiritual and they are permanent. There's three dimensions of the world of change. The fourth can be found in eternity, not infinity, which is the endless succession of moments. Eternity is one moment that never ends. But when you add time to anything, it creates the idea of a process. So, for example, and he uses this example, talk about a man's biography. It's based on movements of time, each event based on the ones before it. They create a whole. The unity of all of those together is what we call form. Another example is that the proper object for someone specializing in botany is not a flower, is not a tree, I guess that's an arborist, but an entire ecosystem, a huge forest. The nature of the zone, is it temperate, is it tropical? But Florensky says this fourth dimension can be conceived of. He uses another example that how a mystic contemplation, you could smell a flower, and me growing up in a funeral home, flowers don't mean much to me. The smell of a flower can represent the entire flower and, in fact, can represent the entire place. It becomes then a symbol. And back to the biography example, it's presenting a supertemporal image of a man. It's above time because it then becomes a static whole once it's finished. That's why writing an autobiography before you die is very difficult. You have to do it in your very old age. Now, creativity, as I mentioned before, labor in the artistic sense, and this may go for other senses too, it's because the whole always comes before the parts, in fact, determines the parts. Artistic creativity, which he was very much concerned with, is to have a flash of inspiration, and the word inspiration, the coming in of the spirit, of a whole, an image, a vision, I shouldn't say an image, a vision, all at once, a gestalt, and it's present in the mind. That immediate inspiration is, in fact, timeless. Now, in more detail, he wrote in 1922, he wrote a lot in 1922, a very strange book on the imaginaries in geometry. Now, most of it is very technical, but it's the end that's very important. He's talking about the nature of the object, the thing, corporeality. And he was very interested in Einstein later on, the concept of the speed of light as this physical speed limit. Nothing earthly can reach the speed of light, let alone beyond it. So if any object can reach the speed of light, it isn't impossible, it's just implying that there's another world in which that could happen, the spiritual realm. If the impossible happens, that a physical object moves at the speed of light, it just means that other worlds have to exist. Everything had to have changed in order for that to happen. And that world we can't even imagine from our present standpoint. So any physical limit, speed of light or otherwise, bumps up against the world of spirit. So if an object moves at the speed of light, given the nature of relativity, time can move to a crawl or even stop. And objects would shrink almost to the point of disappearing, almost technically a nothingness, because that's what the theory of relativity holds, given these variables. If a body moves that fast, it's no longer an extended thing. It's no longer an object, and becomes very stable. This is the glimpse of the origin of the forms in his mind. But if that's true, that means when a body exceeds the speed of light, not only does time no longer exist, but it can go backwards, according to Florensky. Which means that effects can be traced back to their ultimate causes and to the ultimate cause. And he uses an example. He says, you know how when you break the sound barrier, you've broken the physical limitations of air, this boom that you hear. Well, that aspect of light, something traveling at the speed of light, breaks space, let alone time. And the same breakage that causes a sonic boom creates this tear where time can actually go backwards. And this is what he takes from the basic or the special theory of relativity. Strangely enough, he then takes this and connects it with the realm of dreams. He was fascinated with it. He claims, and he's very guarded about this, you know, the great Saint Ignatius, Brian Chaninoff, says that dreams are never to be trusted. He says, however, that dreams are a middle path between these two worlds. The world of the cosmos, where natural laws, including the speed of light thing, all apply, and the spiritual realm, where none of this applies. Almost all of our dreams, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, the physicality doesn't make sense. There is no space, there is no time. I have regular dreams about either being in college or in high school, sometimes at the same time. The buildings morph one to another. Things move very quickly, inconceivably outside of the dream world. Dreams are not subject to physical limits. And he gives an example. Let's say we're sleeping in a bed with a metal frame, and during sleep, during our REM sleep, we roll over and our neck comes into contact with the metal. We may dream at that point that we're being executed by guillotine in the French Revolution. This is his example. But what a dream can do beyond that, you know, it's never just that simple. Dreams are never simple. It will provide the outlines of a story. How did I get here? And it's usually a set of repeating but non-causal states. And I say repeating over months and years. And certainly that's the case with me. But just like the speed of light and beyond, I should say really beyond the speed of light, in dreams, effects seem to precede causes rather than the other way around. There doesn't seem to be connections. And he takes this very seriously. And of all the things that Florensky wrote, this is the book that the Soviets arrested him for. Because he opened up a new vista of consciousness that can penetrate physical limits and then go beyond it to the spiritual realm, which is extremely difficult to understand, which is why the mystic contemplation becomes very important. That was a flower example. And eventually he was sent to the Gulag. Hopefully today we'll get to his political idea, which was written in a couple of days while in NKVD, really a holding cell, while he was being interrogated. The problem was that beyond the speed of light, bodies are no longer corporeal. Time no longer matters. In fact, it can move backwards. Causes exist before effects. I'm sorry, effects exist before causes. All the way back to the greater and greater, more universal causes. But probably his most famous book, also 1921, 1922, The Pillar and Ground of Truth, a series of letters organized by topic. Now, we live in the post-Soviet age. The relevance of this book, and we can't, you know, he's not been canonized, and there's a good reason for this. Today, you know, especially in Russia, but even in the U.S., people who are familiar with the ritual side of the church, the actual physical side, don't know what it means. And there's a few authors out there saying, this is why this book is so important. Florensky is, in fact, a symbolist. But in that series of letters, he talks about what it is to be in church. It's a strange way to translate it, churchliness. So, Bodernost, in other words. And ultimately, the results are that our anxieties are soothed because God, in fact, is in control. Our rationalism, which is a matter of pride, that's tamed and tempered. Our logic is granted a certain peace rather than the disruptive and multifaceted chaos of it. But Sobornost, life in church, within church, is a new one. It's a new life that's tough to explain to people who have no experience with it. It is the juxtaposition of the divine and human. In the Synod of Chalcedon, excuse me, you know, I've said that the Synod of Chalcedon, the very dawn of the Middle Ages, end of the Classical period, is one of the seminal documents of both Western and Eastern civilization. The divine and human entity of Christ, from that unmixed entity, that's where the sacraments and the canons and the ideas of the church are crystallized. The Roman Catholics, especially when this was written, don't have this because the church is physicality. It is the bureaucracy or the hierarchy, and nothing can exist outside of it. And even worse, for the Protestants, it's really a series of texts that Martin Luther either accepted or rejected, and those who came after him. And one of the marks of Sobornost is our connection with real elders. However many, you know, in Athos, there may be a few around. They're not many. But true Sobornost is manifest in these elders. These are the standards of Orthodox life. I'm referring to an article by Vladimir Fedorov, trained in the Soviet Church, worked for the World Council of Churches, attacks Florensky on this score, believing all Christian creeds and really any creed, especially the Jewish one, can lead to salvation. But the entrance to Sobornost, the church, comes from the search for truth. The honest search for truth, not searching for truth that's easy for me or convenient or that connects with everything else I already believe, but the real search for truth, which not only starts but ends in love. Seeking the truth by its very structure means that you are seeking God. See, Florensky, what he's trying to do here is he's surrounded by positivism, these overly simple nihilistic theories of the world. And he says, well, that's fine, but I think we could imply, without the metaphysical assumptions, methods of science to the church. The search for truth is generated by love and then leads to it. Because once you have the truth, you just can't shut up. You're changed. You become different. You then need to communicate it to everyone. truth is somewhat synonymous with light. If you have seen my book on nominalism, that comes up quite a bit. Love, however, truth becomes love when it gets transmitted to others. Truth and love go hand in hand without being identical to each other, of course, which implies that you cannot love in error. Now, I mentioned postmodernism, which is a negation of all of this. Truth doesn't exist, except the Holocaust, of course, and that the Allies were right in World War II, and Hitler was terrible. Other than that, there are no truths. But there's actually something more profound in those examples that I mentioned, where all of a sudden they're all dogmatic. It's that power is all that remains once truth becomes a matter of sophistry. It's reduced to mere opinion. If anything, reason is a barrier. The world is made up of provisional statements and words that have no referent. The truth of the matter is that our reason is meant to mirror the reason of the outside world, a conception, by the way, the Enlightenment rejected. I also mentioned entropy. I connected that with logos. The opposite of entropy is ectropy. And this leads to the creation of a national culture, an integrated system of means to realize and communicate some important value or some hierarchy of value that's taken seriously. But I don't want to abandon this notion of truth quite yet. Truth is something that the person, the man, holds. If that's put into action, it then becomes the good. When perceived by a third party, it becomes the beautiful. Now, that's not an individualistic statement as far as truth is concerned, because our personhood only makes sense when it's perceived and understood by others. That means A doesn't equal A. A personality is intelligible, in other words, only in another. Ferlinski spent a lot of time, as have I, in the concept of love. It's one of these terms that is never defined, but is used pretty much 24 hours a day. Like Heidegger, Father Pavel goes through the Greek and some Russian words that connect the concept of love to history. Eros is important. It was important to Plato, but he defines it as a passion. In other words, to surrender yourself to something, throwing yourself at an ex, the undignified aspect of this. But the most important Greek conception of love is philia. He says it corresponds to the Russian lubit, to like or to love, and it implies an inner closeness, true friendship, a unity. Then, of course, there's storge, S-T-O-R-G-E in Latin letters, which doesn't get mentioned quite as much, but it's a calm and peaceful, confident feeling in the heart of the person who is doing the loving. It's calm and organic, it's permanent, and this can be found in armies, nations, and families. Then agape. This is the more rational, sacrificial, and maybe specifically Christian feeling. It's a love that respects and that is completely unconditional. So the two words that Florensky emphasizes is philia and agape for this reason. Philia is friendship. The term comrade, tovarish, people who are connected, you know, that's the superficial, that's like the collective form idea, throwing people together that have no real connection to one another. Not comrades, but philos, a deeply connected group of people. Now, when it comes to phrases like loving one's enemies or loving one's neighbor, philia is not used. That's where agape is used. when it comes to philia, the highest thing that it creates is a brotherhood of the church, and is manifest most clearly in the liturgy. In Russian, he mentions the word brother, brat, but he also mentions the verb blash, to take, and he interprets it to mean that it's no accident that these two terms, one brother, the other to take, are very similar, because it comes down to the Russian idea of easing each other's burdens, taking the burden from one and taking it on yourself. The church is the highest expression of philia. From there, we can move on to one of his more famous topics, that of iconography. The first thing that the icon does, from an intellectual's point of view, is reject the naturalism of the Renaissance and Enlightenment. That naturalism is almost a negation of art. He's one of the purveyors of the idea of reverse perspective, an aesthetic term that probably everyone who is listening to me has experienced before. Icons show past, present, and future as all one thing. Right now, I'm looking at the Kosovo martyrs from the end of the Middle Ages. You have the battle, you have their ascent to heaven, and God in the firmament looking down, all, at least as far as the implication of the icon, all at the same time. Of course, that didn't all happen at the same time. But icons are meant to go beyond a one-dimensional approach to things, or even a three-dimensional approach to things, for that matter. It shows events and sometimes objects out of order, smaller objects being to the forefront, larger objects clearly being smaller, larger and smaller being in our daily usage. Things that you just can't see from one point of view, from the naturalistic normal point of view, simultaneously from a fixed position. It's non-temporal. A lot of icons are like this, especially the lives icon, you know, the nativity of the Mother of God, usually are surrounded by scenes going back to the Old Testament to be absorbed as one single symbol. Sizes, I already mentioned, don't matter. Convergence doesn't matter, because part of the point of the icon is to go beyond the normal cosmic law. It is beyond it. It doesn't negate it. It fulfills it. But it's another example of going up against physical limits, and once that's transgressed, going into the realm of spirit. You have front-facing and side-facing of the same figure, and the point is to get all angles in one symbol. And this is from the point of view, as he will talk about the astral plane, that our perception is not limited by any preconditions of perception. All are at one point, past and future. The naturalistic idea only sees one perspective at a time. You've seen in a lot of medieval art how animals and trees, sometimes they seem almost bizarrely distorted. And I guess people think that they just didn't know how to draw cats and trees back then. Well, they did, but they're distorted because we're looking at it through reverse perspective. There's a lot more going on than the mere reproduction of something. It's also a perception that discloses both the imminent and transcendent aspects of something. He calls this the synthetic vision. It comes when our spiritual powers are such that it can overcome the sensible world. This is what I mean by limits. The limits of, for example, physics in terms of the speed of light. And what happens when that law, the earthly law, a legitimate law, is transgressed in the realm of the spirit. And it's precisely here Again, now this is the third time I'm mentioning this, where Plato's forms show themselves. This is all seen from, really the same idea of form seen from different points of view. And the truth is that modern man has lost this capacity. Now, he was a name worshiper. He wasn't just any old name worshiper. He was one of the more extreme versions of it. The name glorification controversy created a flurry of writing on the philosophy of language. And he uses this combination of Palamas and Humboldt. Humboldt being in the Romantic era, where a language is an insight into how a nation thinks of itself, its inner thought, its inner form, the connection between the energy of a language and its stable, static structure or its essence. Now, he says that names, and I'm pretty sure he means all words that denote something, but names, words, terms, these are essences of that which they denote. They are not accidental. They're not empty markers. They're meaningful. A language is something that's active, not stable, or at least not purely static. The sound of the word, not just the word itself, but its sound, matches what it is that we're talking about. Now, from that, he takes the most extreme name worship conception he possibly can. He says that divinity is found in the letters and sounds of the divine name. Anthony Bulatovich wrote him, "What are you doing? You sound like a lunatic." Sound is just vibrations in the air as interpreted by our ear. This isn't Christ here. Words work entirely within the mind. The name of God, the soul, and the meaning, or the image, is all one form. And he does connect that with the idea of the Eucharist. Bread becomes divine, bread and wine become divine, and so do words when talking about this, talking about God. To contrast the sound of the divine name, the spelling of the divine name, to contrast that to God is positivism. And he accuses his opponents of that quite a bit. And he says that after the ascension, the dividing line between heaven and earth has not been entirely destroyed, but diminished, at least from our point of view. To reject name worship, he says, is to fall into Nestorianism. Now, he does say where the name is, God is. There's no separation, but there's also no identity. The inner form of the word is the most important. The individual properties of one's speech in a context where you're understood. That's the soul of the word. The outer form, which I have not mentioned yet, is this constant hard matter that the word rests upon. Its body, so to speak. In his About the Name of God, also 1922, he divides a word in three different ways. Number one, it is a physical thing. Sound, the psychological impulse to use it, even its own stability. Number two, the word also is a part of a context of categories, logical and otherwise. Remember, when he's talking about a word in the philosophical sense, he's taking it to contain all definitions and all knowledge and all uses of the word. It's not just an empty sound. So the divine name, you know, I guess he's modified his position here, is the full knowledge and understanding of divinity as it affects us on earth. And that is, as I mentioned, the word's body. Now the soul is the third thing, the word's meaning. That's usually moving and changing. It's in use. It's poetic. You have to know the context, including the historical context, to know what you're talking about at any given time. it can also be a symbol. That's the soul. He goes so far as to say that words are their own little world. It's a world to its own, and that's what he means by the essence. As well as something that can be used to communicate, which is its energy. But the energy can never be separated from the essence in language or anything else, which, by the way, is a problem. Because he extrapolates the nature of words and sounds and denotation and connotation as a universal phenomenon, not merely as a philosophical one or even a theological one. Being is stored in words. And this is collected over centuries, layers upon layers upon layers of meaning. We came across this in Heidegger. His analysis, which we briefly went over, of the different words for love and what they're connected to, is a manifestation of this. You could write books on any of that. Words are self-enclosed, almost a living being. And he was interested in the magic power of words, quote-unquote, because they impact the broader world. And these words can be arranged in a hierarchy. Now, the most powerful words, he says, have the most intent behind it. And by intent, he's talking about things like ritual and incantation, where you don't even really need to understand the terms to create the effect. And this occurs through the third thing that I mentioned, the meaning of the word and its connection to physical thing, which is the first thing. And a lot of his name worship stuff comes from his reaction to Archbishop Nikon, who in 1913 wrote The Great Temptation around the Holy Name of God. In rejecting his argument against name worship, as he understands it, probably the Bulatovian version, this is where Florinsky argues that the essence-energy distinction has a universal application. Anything has that distinction. The name of God is God, but God is not the name. Florinsky flippantly says to Archbishop Nikon that he is a positivist because you can't understand any non-worldly thing found in the world. That everything in the world is measurable, yet the divine energy is not. And of course, that's inseparable from the essence. Remember, names, especially the name of God, includes everything that's been passed down to us in all detail. Again, it's not just, despite what Florinsky says, it's not just words on a page. But these aren't idle speculations. Love is one of the central themes. Love, especially in the eschatological realm, it's a sacrificial self-giving, losing yourself. We can place our personhood elsewhere, sacrifice it even, to recast it on a stronger foundation. Otherwise, it's just self-referential thinking, the snake eating its own tail. It's a cycle of just vapid individualism, masked without substance. That's the world without love, true love. But more than that, the will matters here too. Damnation comes from the conscious resistance to the truths of the Holy Spirit, or God's name. He also talks about universal salvation, apokatastasis, made famous by St. Gregory of Nyssa, where everything that exists will eventually be redeemed in grace. The problem that Father Pavel has with that is that it implies that the person who knowingly refuses the counsel of the Holy Spirit can somehow be forced to recognize it. Freedom is vitiated. There are no acts of will here. This is all quite involuntary. So, Florinsky is saying that hell is something that is self-chosen, and specifically so. Salvation requires a clear separation, the schism, our normal self, with the self that contains an evil character. Accretions coming from the world and the devil. He calls hell a hallucination of nothingness, a nightmare. But an evil character is a schism within man. We're talking about redeemed, baptized men. That splitting creates an autonomous, non-substantial self, pure illusion. This is the fate of the evil character. And given the snake biting its own tail, hell is where the only reality is one's own consciousness. And as such, they can never come to regret their sin. He even goes so far as to call it evil asceticism. It's the key to hell. This is a stiffened resolve where you go out of your way to deny the counsel of the Holy Spirit. And just like what salvation is, expulsion from God's face is an eternal, frozen present, a now. Not an eternity of moments. It's not infinity. It's an unchanging, frozen now. And at some point, everything in our consciousness that is not virtuous will somehow be purged. But it's also hard to believe how a totally evil being, in our experience, can exist, and that God's image somehow has been completely effaced. This is why Nikolai Berdyaev says hell is real, since freedom is so critical to him. God has to respect our choice. He didn't have to give us freedom. He did. Reason doesn't make any sense without freedom, and vice versa. To bring this all together into a synthesis, a unity, that unity is the heart. When I was in grad school, I had a very tough time. I was still a unit then. The Immaculate Heart, the Sacred Heart, then the concept of the heart used in the East. I found it interesting that at the time in the books that I had access to in the university library, the term heart was never defined. I mean, we're not talking about the organ in our body. That's just an analogy, right? Well, in the Eastern realm, the heart is the psychic center. When we talk about Plato's conception of the soul, that's the heart because it includes our abilities as well as our potential. If you go back to our lecture on Skovoroda, we go through a lot of this same material. I mentioned this schism. The schism truly is between the heart on the one hand and the evil person on the other. The heart represents the real person, the essential person, sometimes hidden in sin and pride, but evil, of course, being non-substantial. It creates this self-referential loop. The heart unites the physical and the psychological together with the spirit and with the spiritual realm. St. Macarius of Egypt equated nous, or the highest form of reason, with the heart. Now, Palamas seems to suggest that the soul is generated by the earthly realm. That the intellect makes use of the soul's faculties. But the intellect is, while it's immaterial, it is located somewhere, and it's located in the heart. St. Macarius says that the heart governs all human things. Palamas says, if it's spiritual, it is by definition intellectual. The intellect within the heart coordinates all virtues and vices and all action in general. Now, the intellect and reason, in Florensky, these are distinct. The nous, that's the means of immediate knowledge, intuitive knowledge, of true axioms. Where reason, I usually use the word logic there, is purely discursive. It's a tool on the way to truth. But reason is helpless without the intellect. Florensky's doctrine of the heart brings everything that I've mentioned together. He defines the body as this form, a unity of all man's physical states. It's a unity of parts. But being bodily doesn't mean worldly or fleshly. There's matter and there's flesh, that there's a qualitative distinction there. The problem with being material, in part, is that everything else around us is material. We have that in common with everything, so that means sin will permeate everything around us, not just us. It upended the natural order. That's because we, in our decisions, exist in a material form that we share with everything around us. From the heart, we go to a very strange part of his thinking, and that's his political science. I mentioned that he wrote this in prison near the end of his life. It's called The Proposal for a Political Order for the Future of Russia, which he wrote in 1933. And he has, again, this is during the Stalin era. He sees rule. Now, how much pressure was put on him, I don't really know. But this is very eccentric. You could take it with a grain of salt. But he sees a tightly centralized, singular ruler who was both benign and prophetic. This is the rule of a prophet, a man who was close to God. This kind of spiritual Moses-style figure, we can imitate that. And he mentions Hitler and Mussolini as imitations of the prophetic lawgiver. And that Russia awaits such a leader in its future. There's no doubt that this is an autocrat. His will is not to be fought. One of these prophetic rulers is someone who could remove the conception of so-called representative democracy or liberal democracy from our vocabulary. He must be separate. I mean, the ruler is separate from parties, institutions, interests of any kind. And he comes out and says, Stalin is a model for this. He certainly was no prophet. He wasn't even an intellectual. And that there is a positive sign to the USSR in that this sort of ruler is manifest. Well, it's been manifest in the Old Testament too. Equality is rejected. The state really arranges human beings, putting them into positions where their potential can flourish. This is influenced by Hegel. But the concept of liberal representation, these are arbitrary coalitions. These are parties. These are financial interests, all buttressed by a press that only cares about an angle, not about the truth of the matter, building its interests, supporting powerful people. You can't rule via a majority. A majority isn't institutional. However, these fake mandates that politicians, when they get elected, claim, that's using a majority for cover. It's a pseudo-mandate. But as far as Pavel Florensky is concerned, he doesn't have to be an entirely pure mind. He has to have a powerful will. And all social life has to begin at the top and emanate downward. And he mentions a prophet because a prophet can see where the nation is headed before anyone else. He's able to cut through the extraneous detail and get to the heart or the essence of the matter. The people aren't the foundation. Dialectics is the foundation. Maximum centralization consistent with reasonable rule. Other things, non-political things, can be diverse and multiform at the local level. The only time it can't is if it affects the state. But even a decentralized order, non-political decentralization, still comes from the center. In many ways, diverse interests, clashing in the marketplace of ideas and certain things, can be very good for the state. And each nation has a role to play. Culture is a way to express that and coming to understand it, a specific role in the broader order. Education. Children should remain innocent for as long as possible, protecting them and sheltering them from the realities of evil and sin and politics. He gives a list of what he means by education. It's not just classroom learning, but it's all upbringing. Accurate speech, that is to say, truthful speech, not self-interested speech or writing. Manners, the basic unwritten rules for social life. Self-criticism, as a rejection of pride. Sexual purity, and we all know why that's the case. Devotion both to duty and to the state. To focus on the concrete rather than the abstract. The love of nature and animals. To duty, family, and friends. And then finally, physical education. But there's one thing that he does like to see decentralized, and that is this education. In schools and everything else. Again, from the top down, decentralized. Found in the countryside, not so much in the cities. And he also seems to suggest freedom of religion, including the freedom of anti-religious propaganda. He believes in state capitalism. He believes in things like collective farms, but only so long as they are allowed competition from the communes, from the urban cartels, or simply from individual proprietors. And the state, very much like Fichte, should try to gain autarky, self-sufficiency, to be not subject to international prices or speculation. The medieval idea, according to him, that each man has its own purpose, duty, and station, which overcomes alienation. And this also implies a hierarchy, a manifestation of potential in different areas. But opposition, out of the question. Parties, out of the question. So how do you summarize this? I didn't think I'd get through the whole thing. I'm very happy I did. To try to summarize a man like him in an hour is extremely difficult. I gave you a few glimpses into his system relative to different specialties. But if I could reduce him, I would reduce him to the fact that there is nothing absolute, and in fact, there's everything arbitrary about natural limits as laid out by naturalistic and nominalist science. We're not talking about experimentation. We're not talking about open-mindedness. And science is just as intensely, ideologically enclosed and concerned with money and status as anybody else. Using a word like science is to be dishonest. There is no such entity. There's a scientific establishment. And sometimes it's still shocking to learn that in 1900 and 1910, you still had positivism. Pavlov being taught, even at the seminary level, as the norm. You've also noticed that so much of what I did here is to give some accounting of where the forms come from, whether it be the speed of light thing, or any of the other things that I mentioned where a form can present itself, or even this simple distinction of a collection of parts on the one hand and the system as a whole on the other. That's not a balanced equation. The system is far more important than the individual parts. The difference between organism and mechanism is that the former is constantly adapting. It could pick up the slack for other things, of course, in an actual machine. That can happen. The whole concept of the speed of light, even the reverse perspective, is to say that the spiritual realm lies outside of the assumptions of language and outside of the assumptions of modern ideology. And by that we mean Darwinism and naturalism, nominalism. That's why he spends so much time on dreams. That's why he worries about the implications of an object that can go the speed of light or even beyond it, and what that will mean for space and time. Remember, he's coming at this from the point of view of science, not from the point of view of metaphysics. And he combined the methods of certain sciences with his theological education, and this is what came out the other end. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.